Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Whether you're looking to buy your dream home or rent a sweet apartment, give Redfin your gotta-have-it wish list of property features, and you'll receive real-time notifications tailored just for you. Ready to see it up close and personal? Scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Don't wait to find your perfect match. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Do you like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling too. This week in the news, R-Truth fired, then rehired again. The lazy river of wrestling criticism, ice cold thoughts on Money in the Bank, and whatever else we had time for this week. And then Invader Club, Chris has selected Furnace and LaFon versus the Hardy Boys from Shotgun Saturday Night. Back from vacation, thanks for letting me do that. I am Jeff Hawkins with the birthday boy of 39, Christopher Novemberino.
Hello.
Hi.
I am 39. Thank you.
A little bit of housekeeping, and this isn't really housekeeping per se, but over my vacation, someone kind of important to this show passed away. A guy by the name of Jordan Breen, who did work with the Sure Dog Radio Network. He's one of the innovators of MMA radio, and I was a regular listener of his. And we were friendly on Twitter for a while, and then when SureDog got bought out, he kind of disappeared. Passed away while I was on vacation at the age of 38. Had some depression and some substance abuse issues. But this is going to sound odd to say, but he was the guy I wanted to be when I started podcasting, because the guy was so erudite, so intelligent, good. And then I became just jokey the jokester, or whatever the hell I am now. But when I listen to him, I go, I want that for professional wrestling. And he was a professional wrestling fan as well. And we would chat, and I was a regular, you know, commenter on his show. And I went to him and I said, look, I think I'm too old to podcast. And this is when I was about what Chris's age is right now. He goes, nah, you should do it. There aren't many voices like yours out there. And hey, if you're having fun, who cares how old you are? So without his encouragement, there would be no Shake Them Ropes. There would be no podcast. There'd be no Jeff Hawkins. So I just wanted to take a moment to kind of memorialize him. He hasn't been around in so long, and he is missed, especially in the dumb meathead jock world of combat sports. Intelligent voices are always, always welcome. But we are also a music show, and we had two musical heavyweights pass away this week. Sly Stone, aka Sylvester Stewart of Sly and the Family Stone, and Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. I will let Chris handle Brian Wilson first. How about that?
Well, I think if you are looking at 20th century music history, there are few people more significant in the latter half of popular music than Brian Wilson. not because of his sustaining catalog of hits. He really had a steady run of hits between 1960 and 1967, 68, and then it tapers off pretty significantly, and he just sort of transitions into a music legend. But because of his impact on his peers, most notably, I think, and probably the most well-known, is his impact on the Beatles. The Beatles, Lennon and McCartney, particularly McCartney, viewed Brian Wilson as sort of like a rival, not a rival, but like a benchmark to try to hit, as Brian Wilson was coming up with more and more complicated arrangements for songs, because ultimately this gets to Pet Sounds, where his arrangements become extremely dense and they are coupled with these unbelievably great compositions. He was doing transitional work, much like the Beatles were during their middle period. And Pet Sounds was the major driver for the Beatles as they were recording Revolver specifically. And then also Sgt. Pepper's as well. The impact of Brian Wilson's recording and his outside of the box thinking with recording techniques became something that, like, a lot of psychedelic people strove for. Now, this, of course, was fueled by Brian Wilson's own declining mental health and also his own experimentation with drugs. This yielded, in some cases, very interesting results. For example, on Caroline No, the final track on Pet Sounds, Brian Wilson, to get the weird ambient, almost bongo-like sound that rings in the background at the end of the measure, Brian Wilson actually took a water bottle from the studio, like from the actual water cooler of the studio, brought it to the end of a hallway, and then booped it on the ground, and they mic'd that up, and that is the sound that you are hearing there, among other things. The intro to the album involves Brian Wilson playing the inside of a piano, and people have, in recent years, attempted to recreate this and discovered just how unbelievably tricky it is to play the inside of the piano, because you really don't have a great indicator of what's going on. So Wilson, for his part, really was this genius. But that genius, of course, was coupled with ill mental health. I mean, Brian Wilson at one point drew a giant square or a giant rectangle around his piano. No one was allowed to enter into the piano rectangle when he was playing piano. Among other things, there is the year that he more or less spent in bed, that the Bare Naked Ladies memorialized in a song.
Lying in bed, just like Brian Wilson.
Brian Wilson did, yeah. And Brian Wilson just never really was able to find his footing in the 70s when, frankly, music had... It's not that music had moved beyond Brian Wilson. It's that Brian Wilson was always making, in the 1960s,
pop.
Pet Sounds is beyond that, though,
well,
right?
No, it is. You know, it is. It's very Phil Spector-esque, but I mean,
when you
say the 70s came in, I mean, he wasn't doing psychedelic stuff for the most part. He was, still good vibrations on Pet Sounds and stuff like that.
So. Right, yeah. Or the later stuff, would be like Good Vibrations and that sort of thing. Which Good Vibrations is also an excellent song.
Great song.
Yeah. But the 60s... as a general music decade, was this very permissive, experimental, wide-ranging decade, is sort of what I'm saying. Whereas the 70s, musically speaking, the bandwidth kind of narrows in. Rock kind of more fine-tunes. Expectations out of R&B and soul kind of fine-tune as well.
Yeah.
Brian Wilson and the Brian Wilson California surf sound just didn't really have a place. And then, like, obviously, there's just a lot of complications inside of that Wilson family, too. Dennis Wilson, of course, dying prematurely. And then everyone's favorite member of the Beach Boys, Mike Love. what can't we say about him? But let's keep it focused on Brian Wilson here. I think as a songwriter, as a music teacher, someone who's really into music theory and stuff, to this day, Brian Wilson's compositions are poured over all of us. They are both harmonically and intellectually satisfying, but beautiful. They speak, you know, God Only Knows is such a wonderful song. Yes. I mean, like, his lyrics are so excellently executed in addition to the depth of the composition. So, like, you know, the guy, absolutely a giant in music. You know, I can't say much more than that. And that I did all entirely off without any notes at all.
No, there are two facts about Brian Wilson that live rent-free in my head. One is an interview he did, I want to say 2010, maybe 2015, where the interviewer, he had just seen the movie Norbit with Eddie Murphy, and he was blown away by this movie for some reason, and could not stop talking about it. And then the interviewer goes, well, what's your favorite movie? He goes, Norbit. And then the other one, do you know what Brian Wilson's favorite song was? One that he tried to incorporate into quite a few of his other compositions.
Oh, God, I don't.
Shortening Bread.
Oh, and, yes, yeah.
And there are stories of him calling up, including it. I told you about this. He called up Alex Chilton of Big Star in the Box Tops. Asked him to come over and record Shortening Bread because... because he did like the vocals, I think, that Mike Love had put on this arrangement of Shortening Bread. He had various different arrangements of Shortening Bread based on musical taste at the time and whatever, you know. And he just...
It's a banger hit, you know. It really is.
Interesting enough, you mentioned this. Sylvester Stewart, a.k.a. Sly Stone, kind of responsible for the 1970s entrance into music and whatnot. DJ in San Francisco, if you believe the stories, he's kind of responsible for the San Francisco sound. He was a radio disc jockey and an in-house producer at a local record shop. He produced the very first version of Somebody to Love, which was Grace Slick and her then husband, and written by her brother-in-law. Recorded with that band, and then later when Grace Slick quit to go join Jefferson Airplane, recorded that as a hit. He also had a hit that's called the Introduction to the San Francisco Sound by a group called the Bo Brummels, which a lot of people think are British, but they're actually a San Francisco group called Laugh Laugh. You ever saw...
There were a number of bands that used to do things like that, where they would go and basically perform under an alias for marketing purposes.
Yeah, Laugh Laugh, if you've ever seen Uncle Buck, it's the song that Laurie Metcalf and John Candy are dancing to in the living room when Amy Madigan comes and interrupts them. It's like, Laugh Laugh Before I Die. It seems so, you know, it starts lonely, I'm so lonely, you know, that thing. And then he just decides to go out on his own and start a band, and he purposely made it multicultural and had women in it. He wanted it to be kind of a cross-section of America. And it's so funny because he was also just adamantly not on your side when it came to anything. He's like, there's a song title I can't say on the air, but it refers to both races.
It kind of says,
if you listen to the lyrics of Everyday People, which is a fantastic song, you know, it's like, I am no better and neither are you. We are the same, whatever we do. You love me, you hate me, you know me, and then makes no difference whatever. And I'm everyday people. We got to live together, you know, and that's, you know, no matter what, no matter if you hate people or if you don't like them, you got to live together. He initially not a hit and then started just writing simple songs, and the simple songs are what got in there. Like, if you listen to Dance to the Music, it's basically the same song twice, and he's just introducing people in the band and instruments, but it's a great song. Much like Brian Wilson, kind of peaked halfway through his career. I mean, after the 1973 album Fresh, there's not a lot in the late 70s or 80s catalog, because Drugs and, you know, Larry Graham quit, you know, and he was just such a big part of the, to form Graham Central Station. He had the slap bass fame that got, you know, the bass on Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself is one of the most iconic bass lines out there. couple of good documentaries on it out there, but I mean, the guy just liked drugs and became a recluse afterwards, but he'd be like doing things in the late 70s where he'd be like playing ping pong on Dick Cavett and stuff like that. But I actually got to see him live once, not play music, but just live. The quintessential joke out there is John Henton. I went to see Sly and the Family Stone. Sly showed up once. It's the perfect joke for me. But there was a, I think it was his sister had a Sly and the Family Stone cover band. And he showed up in the Bruce Lee motorcycle outfit with a helmet on, and he never took the helmet off. But you knew it was Sly Stone the whole time. That was kind of a thrill. The set at Woodstock really solidified them as a band, and it's just funny if you listen to it and you think 3 a.m. on Sunday at Woodstock with everybody having bad acid trips and stuff, and here comes Cynthia Robinson yelling at people to dance to the music, which is just great. But definitely an influential band. Vernon Reid calls them the quintessential American band. Listen to their early stuff through 1973. It's just great. And watch Questlove's documentary is good. I won't say it's great. It's called Sly Stone and the, I think it's called The Pressure of Black Genius or something like that. It spends a little too much time on modern day figures who were influenced by Sly Stone, but it's a good primer to Sly Stone. Highly recommend it. But this is a wrestling show. Let's get to the news. While we were gone, WWE released or said they were not renewing the contracts of R-Truth, Carlito, and Sarah Logan, a.k.a. Valhalla. And then people just started deciding to chant, "We want Truth." So back is R-Truth, but not as R-Truth. Back is Ron Killings. And I believe this is because of escalation clauses in R-Truth's contract. I am of the opinion that R-Truth was not screwed in any way. R-Truth was on this roster for 15 years, only having to do comedy bits and making more and more money as the years went on. It's one of those weird things where people think people are treated unfairly, and it's like the guy's like making like a bandit, and I have no problem with that, but it's also kind of like, well, he wasn't really screwed. He got that last significant run on with the Saturday night's main event thing. I'm happy he's employed. He's not hurting for money is what I'm trying to tell people. Carlito kind of abrupt because of the whole Judgment Night thing, which is now Judgment Day, Judgment Night being the 1993 movie, Judgment Day, and they just drop it and never mention him again. You know, there's no PS5 that he's playing the video game to advertise that in the background anymore. They just move on with their lives. And I was just like, I think they should have written him off in some way. I think he deserved that for all the bumps he took.
And to this point, he's on the game. So it's like one of those things where you should just complete the circuit. It's not really all that hard. Yeah, I mean, you could just have him decide that he's bored of being in the Judgment Day. Like he's like, I never really do anything. I never really do anything here, guys.
It could be a meta story, and I don't like meta stories. But yeah, you could do hey, I don't think you all are cool anymore. And he spits the apple out and he leaves. And that's it. That's what you could do. R-Truth is, I mean, Sarah Logan, she hadn't been around in a while. You know, she's been released before. She just became a mother and she's moving on to do wrestling, even though I think she wanted to come back. But, you know, there's no use for her. But R-Truth is one of those things where it's like we love him as the comedy character, but now he's back as serious Ron Killings. And I don't know if people want to see that necessarily. I think they want to see the dumb, you know, oh, my bad kind of comedy type thing. It's a weird way to bring him back, Chris, just a bit.
I mean, it's strange in one sense, but I also would have brought him back like this because I believe that he has visually aged out of being wacky, zany R-Truth and having that look. So even if he goes back to being more comedic in the future, I think he needs a visual palate cleanser to transition into whatever that is going to be. So why not have a more serious run for a second? Not necessarily more serious as in we're going to push Ron Killings to the top, right, but more serious, like, I like him being a thorn in John Cena's side.
Yeah.
For the rest of this title reign, that he's still obsessed with John Cena, but now in a completely different way. Or, like, I don't know, the idea that he could have a chip in his shoulder. Now, this being said, there, R-Truth is always impressive in terms of performance for his age.
Yes.
But does that mean that I like R-Truth matches? No. Generally speaking, no. Now, that being said about that being said, I think it's entirely possible that Ron Killings knows enough about professional wrestling and the psychology of professional wrestling that he might have some other match format up his sleeve that could be not, you know, amazing work rate stuff, but stimulating to watch. And I'm at least open to seeing if that happens. I would not, you know, bet anything of substance on it happening.
No, this is a crowd control move, and this is to shut people up. And I don't think this move. I don't think this.
Well, that's the best part is WWE completely played themselves.
We listened to the fans.
No, on this contract crap, right? Like they gave R-Truth a high profile angle against John friggin' Cena, who was putting him over like $1 million, and then all of a sudden, now they have no choice but to re-sign Ron Killings when they would have been perfectly fine to let him go.
Right. Officially announced, WrestleMania is going to be in Vegas next year. I believe it's the 19th and the 20th. Here's what I will say. TKO likes their Mania in Las Vegas, but if you're going to go, book a room now. I've made a reservation just in case. I don't think I'm going to use it, but because also that week is the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, which means rooms are going to be in short supply and the prices are going to be jacked up. So if you want to go to Mania, just make the reservation. You don't have to use it. How about that?
Yeah, there you go.
As seen on Worlds Collide, Mr. Iguana is expected to bypass NXT and show up on the main roster. We had video packages of him this week. This guy, I want to be his accountant, get paid. WWE already primed and ready with iguana puppets and t-shirts of this guy, whereas AEW couldn't get the mini Monet puppets out or a deal made for those, which would have been a huge seller. Look, I'm going to say it. Yeah, Mr. Iguana, comedy character, I get it, but he's going to be a bigger star than almost anybody on the AEW roster by doing this dumb crap. I'm just going to say it that way. And he's going to get paid. And that's what matters in wrestling. You can have your great matches and all that other stuff, but if you're getting paid and you can make a lot of money in a short time, why not be Mr. Iguana, Chris? I don't know. I kind of enjoy the shtick, to be honest with you, because it's kind of a sorbet for the bangers, but at the same time, I realize how dumb it is.
Yeah, I think you and I always knew that Mr. Iguana was too big for NXT.
Well, why should they put him on NXT? He's a comedy guy, and
I mean, honestly, it's pointless to put
him. He's a merch machine. Merch machine, dude.
I think so. I think the kids will want to have their face painted like Mr. Iguana.
Yes.
I think. Yeah.
Weed jokes are right there for the older fans who miss Matt Riddle. I mean.
Yeah.
We've had a lack of marijuana-centric wrestlers on the WWE roster of late.
We really have. We are due in for that one who just likes to smoke a little bit.
That would be Mr. Iguana, I think. Yeah. Yeah,
oh, you think he came up with that gimmick while high?
Hey, get this. I'm really an iguana, and I have a puppet. Nah, man, smoke some weed.
What's your name going to be?
Thinking.
What's your name going to be? Mr. Iguana.
L. Iguana. Los Iguana.
Senior Iguana.
Senior Iguana. How about Mr. Iguana? Oh, that works for me. I kind of like the puppet, though. I do. I like that people treat the puppet as real. It's such a stupid, straight, absurd gimmick. Now, don't do this on the main event roster. Just keep him mid-card Orange Cassidy as opposed to main event Orange Cassidy, and he'll be fine. I like that comparison from Dave Meltzer. I think he could be WWE's Orange Cassidy in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think he certainly... He could be a short-term stopgap for the R-Truth comedy spot, honestly. Yeah.
No, yeah. Actually, now that R-Truth is not the comedy guy and Carlito's been gotten rid of, we need a new generation of younger comedy guys in WWE, and I don't know if they're going to transfer Miz into that. He probably should be at this point.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we do need some less serious wrestlers that people can beat, but that people get an emotional reaction to. I have no problem with this whatsoever.
Yeah.
The lawsuit filed by Kevin Kelly and Brent and Brandon Tate was moved to arbitration by Judge Harvey E. Schlesinger in U.S. District Court for the Middle District of Florida. AEW had petitioned move it to arbitration, citing all three contracts had clauses that any issue with contracts had to be settled through arbitration and not in court. Side note, I'm sure they knew who their arbitrator was supposed to be, as opposed to my arbitration, where I can't get an answer on that. Anyways, Schlesinger did deny the AEW motion to have the case completely thrown out. The lawsuit was against AEW as well as announcer Ian Riccoboni. So that pretty much went as we thought. If you have an arbitration clause and you agree to it, it will probably be enforced. Hint, hint. Mm-hmm. For the Amazon Prime version of American Gladiators being hosted by The Miz, even though he's not doing play-by-play, Chris Roses, which is ridiculous. Out of the 16 Gladiators, some familiar names from the world of professional wrestling, including people we were wondering where they were, including Rick Boogs, Camille, Jessica J-Rod Roden, Wardlow, Mr. Pectacular Jesse Godders, is also in there from Lucha Underground. But yes, Wardlow and Camille from AEW on a show hosted by a WWE guy. Oh, the mind boggles, Chris. But man, I think Wardlow's going to be great on American Gladiators. I think he's going to be like that Gemini character on the original where, you know, he had personality even though he didn't say anything.
Yeah. I mean, there were a number of those guys on the original American Gladiators that I wouldn't have mind seeing do professional wrestling just because they looked the part, you know?
I'm one of those people who liked the Battle Dome show, if you ever watched that, where Terry Crews originated as T-Money, but then they had that WCW crossover, and that wasn't very cool.
I do remember Battle Dome. I've been going back and rewatching Battle Bots, if you ever watched that show.
Yes.
Yes.
Subject to Change Without Reason being my favorite robot.
A classic, and classic.
Also my favorite intro for any robot ever. I've been watching, I've been finding copies of the original Roller Games on there, and I always liked the booking because they would do heel versus heel booking, and you had like tweeners. But yeah, no, those shows were always neat. I'm a fan of American Gladiators, but I'm wondering what events are going to be bringing over because there's so much that has surpassed American Gladiators, and it's also one of those things where it's like people don't want to get hurt anymore. And that original American Gladiators had some events where if you weren't careful, like that whatever that almost football, I mean there were a couple of football, there was the football game, but there's also the one where you had the like the balls that you had to put in different buckets, like if you could get through divide and conquer, I think was the name of it. Don't get me wrong, but it's like there were guys just getting their shoulders blown out, getting thrown onto that turf on the ground in that game. I assume it's mostly going to be the things like shooting and then the obstacle course. I'm here for it. All right, that'll do it for the news. Now for the lazy river of wrestling criticism, whatever we had time for, whatever we watched. We have a plethora of things to go for. We can do ice cold thoughts on Money in the Bank Worlds Collide up until this week. And since I watched those and did not give you guys audio on that, both shows were solid. Worlds Collide kind of suffered to me from the WWE influence in that they like to only highlight you know, they beat half the talent in AAA, but they highlight the guy that they think is the star of AAA, which is Vikingo. But Vikingo and Chad Gable had a very good match. Commentary was shockingly good. And I don't mean that as a slam on the guys, but Corey Graves was doing the play-by-play. And Conan was doing the color. And I don't like Conan at all. I really don't. But he was solid. And Corey Graves did a Michael Cole at Beast of the East type of performance to me, if that makes sense. You know, out of the range of being heavily, heavily produced, he was allowed to speak a little more freely. He knows a lot about Lucha Libre because his brother, Sam Adonis, in AAA. So it was one of the, and he felt impassioned about the product. He wasn't there under duress. It felt like he was very excited to be there. So it was a fun watch. Money in the Bank was solid, I thought. Did you get a chance to see Money in the Bank at all?
I did. It was days ago at this point.
Yes, it's hard to remember, but I mean, it was solid, but it was but I'd call it unspectacular. How about that?
I mean, yeah, nothing particularly stood out.
The,
yeah,
the ladder, the women's ladder match, I thought was good and quote unquote safe. The men's dragged on a bit, and I really, you know, I get that we have to have outside interference because of the Seth Rollins thing, but then bringing in the I actually thought, you know, who had a good night on that night was Solo Sikoa and his personality, because nobody was more excited for Jacob Fatu to come out. He's clapping, he's shaking, they go, yeah, I'm gonna win this thing, and you're like, that's some unexpected good comedy out of Solo Sikoa that I was watching. Gable, of course, had the best weekend probably of anybody, and I really liked at the end. I didn't like the entire match, but that the John Cena, Logan Paul versus Cody and Jey Uso match, the end of it was spectacular, and Logan Paul, horrible human being again, but hell of an athlete. And just that moonsault was kind of amazing. The spot with the drone was really, really cool. And I thought Lyra Valkyria had a very good match. I thought the contrivedness of the tights pull for the win was kind of dumb. Have Becky do a real cheap type of spot.
I thought that this Lyra Valkyria Becky Lynch thing is never going to get there for me, is what I've concluded. I do not care for this, and I will not care for this. And
I think we've moved on, though, given what happened on Monday.
Yeah.
With Bayley coming back. I think Lyra might end up being a different kind of heel. I don't know. She's improved, but it's not one of those things where I want to watch her cut heel promos just yet either.
I don't blame Lyra either. I just think Becky was an absolute heat vacuum on Lyra. Because she never got a chance to really get over on her own merits before Becky showed up and just started doing whatever the hell it is she's been doing and whatever you want to call that.
And Becky was playing to the back of the room on that match, too, and Money in the Bank again, too. So, so that's the ice cold thoughts. I'll let you start with the modern for this week thoughts, Chris.
The modern for this week thoughts. All right. So, starting modern here, I guess we need to talk about AEW's recent format of beat 'em into submission. If is this working for the ratings? Can I start there, Jeff? How are the ratings been on these four-hour mega dynamites?
They've actually been pretty good.
Have they?
If you quantify it with them going against, say, the NHL and NBA playoffs, they're doing quite well until you get to about 2.5 hours, and then they start to die off.
Okay, what does that mean numerically? I understand what that means vibes-wise.
Don't ask me the numbers because I don't have them in front of me.
Can you ballpark me?
I'd say about 680.
680? I mean, that's not bad. I guess the perception coming into these shows is more is more, but then to your point, after about 2.5 hours, I don't know that people feel that way. And I don't like 3-hour Raws. I don't need a 4-hour Raw, nor do I need a 4-hour Dynamite. There has not been a weekly television show of professional wrestling in my lifetime that I need a 4-hour edition of, because it's murderous. You know what a 4-hour wrestling show is called? Used to be called a pay-per-view. Now we call it a special event, but it's not. You don't run it. You don't run it as weekly television. So like,
clashes didn't even last 4 hours, and those were better than any of these things.
No, I mean, and those were built to in more meaningful ways. God, if you're gonna do a 4-hour show, you'd have to have stuff to really build to almost a mega card for that 4-hour show. And then
can I defend AEW here, because we get kind of a bad rap on AEW. I thought this week's 4-hour show was better than last week's. Not that I wanted it to be 4 hours, but in terms of
will change the hearts and minds of our detractors.
But last week was all, you know, expanded party matches, and this one had that Swerve Ospreay match. Don't get me wrong, it was good. Dave Meltzer put in the AP wrestling star rating grading by giving it 5.25. I was like, it was not a better than perfect match. Don't give me that crap just because you like Ospreay. But the rest of the show, at least for the most part, was angle building to the big pay-per-view in July. At least if you cut off the Dynamite part. For some reason, we like front loading the first 2 hours with the important stuff and calling out Dynamite, and then the collision half is just, what the hell are we watching right now? Like, don't get me wrong, I love watching Queen Aminata basically implode her career by going stiff on Thekla over and over again, and then having a temper tantrum and walking out. I don't know what was going on. Did she think she was going to be able to beat Thekla? Did she think she was going over on this night? I don't know what happened. That match was a beautiful, beautiful mess. But like the Kenny stuff, the Will Ospreay stuff.
But that's the thing.
The
it's
Fox.
Like the most interesting stuff on the latter half of these shows are things where
car accidents.
Yes, things are going off the rails, and you're like, huh, that's the weird route. Interesting. All right, we're doing that.
You know, I mean, they hit the notes for their top programs in the first 2 hours. That's cool. And everybody, you know, all the AEW fans getting into me, but it's like, there you go with a video package, Jeff. Yes, because it was a great video package, and they should have done it. It was the minimum they could do instead of referring to an 8 or 9 year old angle from New Japan Pro Wrestling that at most 250,000 people have seen. Yes, it's a good thing to recap angles that you're talking about on television. Jeez Louise. And it was good to get the New Japan footage for that. But, you know, I like Okada in the Callis family. I think it gives it an opportunity for either him or Takeshita to eventually turn. I mean, the Young Bucks and the, you know, and Hangman and all that. I mean, most of that stuff is the stuff I want. I want build. You know, if I want bangers, I'll go watch the NXT match between Oba Femi and, What was the dude's name? The LFG winner?
Oh yeah, Jasper Troy.
Jasper Troy, which is a terrible name. It sounds
such a good name. He sounds like a mountain miner from the 1860s.
You know what?
Jasper Troy's gold mine.
He's one of the characters from Face Off. That's what. But look, that was a big mean guy, sloppy, not technically sound match, but it felt violent and it felt like it had heat to it, which I will take most weeks over emotionless, clean, technically sound, but people are trying to tell me it's violent wrestling, such as Will Ospreay. You kind of had a thought about this too that I want to throw to so you can get in trouble.
Yeah, look, sounds weird and counterintuitive and almost hot takey, but it's just a sentence that popped into my mind as I was watching this week's 4-hour edition of AEW's weekly television program, which is that I kind of hate bangers on weekly television.
Yep.
What I mean by this is not that I hate banger matches, but I need my weekly television wrestling show to have one quality match and then a number of preliminary exhibitionary buildy sort of matches and promos. This is kind of the continuity I want, because I want most of the world built for the show that I'm watching done on the weekly television. And then when I want those banger matches, that's what I want out of a pay-per-view.
Yes. Yes.
And what really bothers me too, both companies are kind of guilty of doing this, but AEW is way worse about this. Stop burning these premium matchups on weekly TV for no friggin' reason. Like, what there are all these like dream matches or whatever. The first time guys touch is on an AEW Dynamite, and it might not even be the main event when that happens. I don't need bangers on weekly TV.
We're building to Speedjet or whatever the hell their name is versus the Hurtson to get, and we've beaten Speedball Bailey on television like the last 2 weeks. So who cares about the tag match? Stop that. Yeah. What was I gonna say? Oh, I was almost tuned out almost immediately off of AEW because last week in the promo, Will Ospreay said, "Oh, me and Swerve, we have to fight. We have to fight. You know, I have to beat, if I have to beat some sense into him, blah, blah, blah." And how does their match start? With the stupid Code of Honor. And I am so done with the Code of Honor. I'm done with Ian Riccoboni, but I'm done with the Code of Honor more than anything. I don't care about Ring of Honor mythos in my AEW. I don't want it. I just want heat. I want people to hate each other and then to come, "Oh, I have mutual respect. Now I'm going to start kicking you in the head. And now then I'm going to come." It's just, stop it. Stop it. Here's a note, and I don't know which one to do, but I'm going to do one of my notes from Raw. Let's do the lead, and then I'll get to the minor one next. It's Jey Uso Gunther match. Was there.
Yeah, right for a belt change match.
It was a fart in church, man. I thought, in terms of heat, in terms of emotion, in terms. I get that Gunther is an honorable bad guy. I get this. But to just have him put Jey Uso to sleep. This was, I thought at the end of this night, my Babe Ruth calling my shot was that I thought Seth Rollins was gonna cash in on one of these two, and then we'd be turning Gunther kind of babyface by saying Jey Uso has honor, but you don't, Seth Rollins, for running into this match, cashing in and getting the title, and that would kind of start a Gunther babyface turn. Instead, he puts him to sleep. They kind of screw up the finish because Jey actually got the rope and then they never broke it, which is a big, big, big no-no. You got to find a way out of that. And then it's just, put him to sleep, and now he's no longer champ. And he might not have ever been the guy, but I don't think they ever really tried to make him the guy either. This is like that first Jeff Hardy, that first CM Punk title runs that Vince used to do, where it's like, we don't really want to get behind him, but we want the people to be able to do the chants or what. We want people to yeet, but we don't want people to think that Jey Uso is a credible champion type thing.
Yeah, look, he might not be the guy in terms of work rate. I've never been there on that, but his crowd connections well outperformed my expectations. People
doesn't even need to have work rate though. He just needs to be shown really as a guy doesn't. Who can he can be shown as a guy who can dominate a match as opposed to being always in danger. He could be a strong champion is what I'm saying, as opposed to a weak champion. That's the difference here.
No, he could have been. I think the tone of this match from Jey Uso was wrong in the sense, like, and this gets to the agenting, if you will, and the booking around the match. Jey Uso should have came out as a house of fire in the idea that he wanted to shut down Gunther. That this was like, he wanted to close the book entirely. Like, this is not going to be some new chapter. I'm closing the book for you, Gunther. You have to move on after this. And so He should have been coming out House of Fire and really had Gunther on the ropes. And then Gunther is essentially fighting back as somewhat of a heel underdog. I think this is important because I think that where this story is ultimately going is Seth Rollins is going to cash in on Gunther. Basically in the nobody ever saw it coming heist of the century sort of move. Rather than going and cashing in on the babyface champion, you cash in on a heel champion who you want to make babyface and do that with Gunther.
The other problem with this whole thing was that the story they wanted to tell is a story they couldn't tell, but they still tried to tell it anyways. Let me lay out my case here. The case here is that Jey Uso has been getting his ass beat in various matches the past 2 weeks and beginning his ass beat by trying to save his friends the entire 2 weeks. He should be almost in a de facto body cast coming out here and trying to finish his match quickly against Gunther. The problem is Gunther is a man of honor, so he shouldn't be trying to take advantage of that, but he basically said, I'm taking advantage of that in his promo last week. For the go home for the show, he goes, you're going to get your butt kicked at Money in the Bank, and then I'm going to have a title match against you in Phoenix, and I'm going to take your title because you're weak. And they didn't want to tell the story that Jey Uso was weak. They didn't want to do the DDP. I mean, they said it when he missed the splash. Oh, there's the ribs, and they've been hurting
him. Right, right.
But he's not wrapped up like DDP necessarily. I mean, he's wrapped up a little bit. I mean, this guy should be almost dead to the point where Gunther almost feels bad for having to do a match against him. And then Jey Uso comes out and almost beats Gunther in that first 10 minutes or so, like almost gets a flash pin. And then Gunther just wears him down and beats him. And, you know, it was just one of those things where it's like there's a story to tell there and nobody wanted to tell it. And it made for a meh match, and now you're just kind of having to figure out, okay, what do we do with Jey Uso next? And I don't know, because Sami Zayn's a far more interesting character with this whole cross thing. It appears that Goldberg's coming back to fight Gunther at Saturday night's main event. You know, he's kind of now a B, not even a B-plus character. He's almost has to go back to a Bloodline story, and you don't know what it is with him.
I think he's going to be... Well, I think maybe we'll reunite the Usos. You know, we'll do the tag team. Possibly with Roman. Yeah, you could do that. I mean, you know, Jay could be, you know, you could also do the Usos and Sammy where they finally get back together. Yeah. You know, he's going to be
a crowd pleaser.
Is a crowd pleaser, right? And people like the Jay and Sammy dynamic works. And I also think the Jay and Sammy dynamic works to cover up Jay's incompleteness as a promo.
I get that. Here's the weird thing to me. I think the end game is Karrion Kross eventually has to be right about Sami Zayn being an opportunist. I don't know why, but it's one of those things where it's like, or somebody has to turn on Sami, and it might be Jay, but are we going to keep Sammy as the beacon of bright light, the hope spot? He has to fight against his urges to cheat to win. And then he finally overcomes. But see, that's also the weird thing, because I don't want Sami Zayn and Goldberg to be interacting with each other in any way, circling around this Gunther storyline. They kind of have a weird... painted into a corner because of the Jey Uso as former champion thing now, where he's not in the title mix, but they have to think of reasons to keep him on television in a high profile way while also pushing somebody else who's aligned with Jey Uso. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do.
Okay, your turn, sir.
All right. Okay. Let's see. CM Punk and John Cena had a promotional exchange where CM Punk wanted to have a match this week in America on the television program they were currently on. John Cena, being the heel, decided that the match would have to wait. It would have to wait to the pay-per-view, which used to be more of a boo line when you asked to pay money for that event. And then also, just to make sure everyone boo it, that the event was going to occur in Saudi Arabia.
Yes. Remember when...
Timing couldn't be better for this, honestly. I think the Saudi show's well-timed.
Remember when CM Punk told The Miz to go suck a blood-covered, blood money penis on Twitter?
Yeah.
I don't know, Chris, because I don't think this is going to happen. I still think CM Punk won't go to Saudi Arabia.
I think if his mind was open to it, it has probably been moved away from it here, given recent events.
I think this is being used for heat. I don't know that for a fact. I think eventually somehow he'll get screwed out of his Saudi Arabia match. I don't know. Maybe Sammy will be replacing him. I don't think Goldberg's going to be in Saudi Arabia going over anybody. That might be a little weird.
I don't think so.
So, it's just, and I understand, look, of course, the commentariat was all, oh, look what a hypocrite Phil is. It's like, but that's the whole point of the angle, too, is that John Cena is such a jerk that he wants to make CM Punk a hypocrite to come to Saudi Arabia. And it's a little bit too meta for me, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And I'll tie it in with my other point about Raw that I wanted to bring up, because I thought this was a bad move as well. The Nikki Bella promo. I liked Liv coming out. I liked her wanting the thing. I hated the story about bringing up her divorce. Number one, because of the nature of the divorce, when you consider she's paying alimony, even though he or she had accused him of abuse, is a little weird. But also, there's just a general rule in television. I already don't like meta stuff necessarily in wrestling, but never say a line on television you're never willing to have people explain. And if people don't know what she's talking about, and you don't want to explain it because it's uncomfortable, then it's too uncomfortable to put on television. That's all fair. I'm going to say. I just think that's a bad move. I don't like Nikki Bella. I really don't. I think she should go away. I think her time has passed. I think she was a big star, and that's nice, and she can come back for the occasional thing. But I think now it's kind of like, my celebrity has waned a bit, and I need to come back and get the. And Brie is apparently coming back too for this Revolution pay per view.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and it's like the Bellas were never. I mean, the Bellas want credit for the Women's Revolution. And
I mean, they get it in the sense that they were sort of the poster child of the thing that the Revolution was going against.
Give Divas a chance, but then again, the Horsewomen were down in NXT killing it, and they we can do that too, and they can't. Okay, let me just put that out there. They're not as good as any of the four Horsewomen ever were.
No.
The
best Nikki Bella match is in the upper third of Becky Lynch's catalog.
Yeah, or Sasha Banks / Mercedes. Sasha. It's probably in the lower third of.
Third of hers. Bailey. Yeah, of Bailey.
Charlotte.
Yeah, lower third. Yeah, yeah, right. And Charlotte's now had enough mid-ass matches that it might be in the upper third of Charlotte.
I don't think I'm going to mind the position, though, on the card here, because it looks like it's going to be Brie and Nikki for the tag titles against Liv and Raquel. So I think that's fine.
That's fine. A nostalgia thing.
Yeah, I'm going to lay off my hot take there for a moment and backtrack a little bit of it. Still not the biggest fan of the Bellas in the world, but they're here. Your turn, sir.
Okay. NXT. Continues to be a bit of a segment-to-segment mess of a show here.
Yes.
I'm going to focus in specifically on the Sean Spears faction, which seems to be aimlessly doing stuff, but not with any clear direction or purpose, and it's unclear who, if anyone, is ultimately going to benefit from the twists and turns of the culling other than themselves.
I hate this group so much, Chris.
They suck really bad. In an era of notably bad factions in NXT, they stick out because I find myself more and more puzzled by this unit. First, I thought it was kind of the run-of-the-mill. Sean Spears runs the faction of younger people. Okay, that makes sense, and he recruits everyone. Now it appears Izzy, in fact, runs things over Sean Spears.
And it's... Here's what's going to happen with this, because the whole thing of the culling was its weakest member.
Sean's going to get kicked out.
Well, was the most interesting. I always forget Buchanan's NXT name for some reason.
Nico Vance?
No. Buchanan, the virgin, as Brian Alvarez calls him. The guy who used to team with Brooks Jensen.
Josh Briggs. No, is Brooks Jensen.
That's Brooks Jensen. Okay. Brooks Jensen was the most interesting part of that, this fact. Right. Because he was lost, and then Sean Spears found him, and now you're my reclamation project. And then Izzy Dame, who is just Izzy Dame. She's never been anything other than Izzy Dame in terms of her character. She's Izzy Dame. And she comes in, and now she is taking. Yes, that's the whole. She's going to get rid of Sean Spears, who has been the personality, but has not shown any personality since that first week. He's just been generic cult guy who says we're the culling, and we cull, and when we cull, we do the culling, and we're so culling together. Nico Vance is a guy with a mohawk like Sean Spears. That's all he is.
Yes.
And so now Izzy Dame has now effectively become the personality of this faction, much like they're trying to pull a Judgment Day thing here. And it doesn't work because Izzy Dame has never been any more deep than the name Izzy Dame. That's the thing here. I like Izzy Dame as a...
I like her in the ring.
I like her, but as a personality, she's big.
No, yeah.
And she's Izzy Dame. I mean, there's no more to say about that. She's a bigger.
Yeah.
She's. I mean, it's kind of like what Lash Legend has become a little bit, where it's like I'm Lash Legend, and I'm big. Okay. You know, once she got out of the metaphor, she's just Lash Legend. And you just
breaking up metaphor. I mean. Why did they do that if they had absolutely no plan for any of these people?
Well, and that's the thing. They have no plan. It's like, okay, Izzy Dame is head of the culling. And what's she doing? She's culling the members of the culling.
Culling, yes.
Who have never had anything other than being members of the culling. They haven't improved. They haven't, you know, all of their vignettes are, they're like Gallus. We're just talking about being Gallus right now. We're just talking about being the culling. And someday we're going to run things. Okay, how are we going to do that? Because we're the culling. All right. It's like we had a family in NXT. We had the D'Angelo family. All right, how are we taking over NXT? By being the family of NXT. And feuding with these people. Okay, so what does the feud get you?
At least it made some sense with the idea that they viewed the North American title as an important part of having political status inside of the organization. That the belt represented something significant to them being power brokers. The way Tony D'Angelo was the power broker was by being, or the way he was the Don, not necessarily the head of NXT, but like the Don, was by being North American champion and being like the formidable upper mid-card champion. The Collins never even had that.
WCW did something like random like this once on a Clash of Champions. It was like, they had this weird group with like, Jake the Snake Roberts was in and out. Cactus Jack was part of it. You had Abdul the Butcher, you had the Barbarian. You had Dick Slater in there. You had Tony Atlas. And Cactus Jack just decides to turn on the Barbarian one day. You're just like, why? Okay, cool. And then they never really pushed the Barbarian as a babyface. This is kind of the same thing. It's like, All right, Izzy Dame decides to hit Brooks Jensen with a chair because he wasn't living up to the standards of the culling. All right, what are the standards? He wasn't a true believer in us. Nobody watching is a true believer in the culling.
Yeah, right.
Hit them with a chair? I mean,
what are the culling's beliefs?
Yes, what's your charter say? What is the whole point of this group other than to be a group? Well, he didn't believe in us as a group. Probably because you have no endpoint as a group. You know, I'm just watching this going, we exist to exist. And we have had a long history of existence, as they said in Animal House. It's one of these things where I'm just like, this is so, this isn't even one note. This is half of a note. And they're trying to play it over and over and over again.
Yeah. Half of a note. There's
like
just
Dark
there's
State. Just, what is he? We're taking over.
They ain't doing nothing. Dark State stinks.
Nobody's doing anything. The No Quarter Catch Crew isn't doing anything.
No,
Dark State isn't doing
stupid.
Anything.
As I said, this is a show in an era of crappy factions. The culling stands out, but like there are many notably crappy factions. Not the least of which are Women's Champion with
Fatal Influence.
Yeah. Yes.
I like JC as a champ, and I liked that. It's just then she's cutting a pretty good promo, and then we have like women from LFG, we have women from the back, we have every woman come out to cut a promo, and then we premiere Mariah May, who is now Blake Monroe, is that the name?
Yeah, Blake Monroe. But I also don't think that the Fatal Influence side chicks are doing anything for JC
Jane
at this point.
No, because they're going to turn. Because we're waiting on Fallon Henley to turn on JC.
I mean, I think the move here and what would actually make her a more meaningful champion is if JC turns on her side chicks and basically goes like, "I'm doing this on my own now."
Okay.
Like, still as a heel, but she turns on them before they can turn on her.
I think they're doing a good job with Blake Monroe. I think the Sabrina Carpenter intro video that they did. If there was an IP attorney, they should probably be getting a lawsuit together because it was a shot-for-shot remake of a Sabrina Carpenter thing, as seen on Twitter. And look, I think here's the question that was bugging me, Chris, because this is a lazy river. We kind of go all over the place. Who loses the most from Mariah May / Blake Monroe being in WWE? Is it Blake Monroe? Is it Charlotte? Or is it Tiffany Stratton?
Tiffany Stratton, because I feel like her momentum is slowing down at a notable pace. Because
she has a culling problem on the main roster. It's Tiffy time.
It's Tiffy time.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's all she has right now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We got the Tiffy time thing.
We get it. Toodles. Okay, now let's do, because she's a heel as a baby face, and they don't want to do anything as a baby face with her. It's the most confusing character on the main roster right now for me, I think, because it's like she's good, but we don't want to push her to the moon. But we also don't want to make her likable. They make her totally unlikable, but she's a baby face. And you're like, okay. So we're supposed to cheer for her?
Right. Like, I think they got into this weird thing when that Barbie movie came out where that was big. They already had kind of a built-in Barbie character. Here comes Tiffy, and Tiffy was over at the, like, a lot. It was sort of a perfect storm of events. But now the Barbie thing is behind us by a year. And like that was a, you know, 1 year summer Barbie sort of thing, not like a cultural moment where things change and she's now in the zeitgeist. And so where does that leave Tiffany Stratton as a character? Well, she's gotta mix it up with people in a way that's amusing. How does she rub Liv Morgan the wrong way? I couldn't tell you. How does she rub? Give me another heel. She could go down to NXT and
Naomi.
Naomi. How she rubs Naomi the wrong way?
Because Naomi's going to cash in on her probably more than likely and win that title. And you're just like, okay, cool.
Yeah. You have to have her like almost delighting in ruining heel's days. Like she still has some of those same mean girl tendencies. It's just that she likes being a mean girl to heels.
Oh, I would have gone the other way because she's a baby face. And I don't want her to be a mean girl. Like, you remember when Alexa Bliss first went under the spell of the Fiend or whatever and became this kind of dark character where she was living in her own weird world doing these sketches and stuff like that, and that's kind of how she got over.
It's time. I see where you're going.
Well, no. I'm going the opposite. As a baby face, she needs to be poly positive all the time. And so everything is bright and sunny, and it ends up ruining the heels' day because she's such a positive force within there. The problem is she can't get that mean girl out of her, and the mean girl doesn't translate well as a baby face. Right?
I think it does if you are roasting heels and actually getting good laugh lines out of them.
That's actually true. They just don't. The other problem is they have heels with very thin skins like Charlotte on the roster, where you can't get one up over on them, or you get swallowed whole on the mic type of a thing.
Right. Yes, I know. Right. Like if Tiff could get some, like, you know, points scored on Charlotte, and then also in these physical exchanges, basically always kind of end up at least in that first altercation with the upper hand.
Yeah.
Right. Like she gets under the heel skin. The heel tries to just attack her directly. Tiffany shows that she's got enough physicality that she can withstand a full frontal assault from a heel. And then the next time around, the heel does something sneaky like attack her backstage or hit her with a steel chair.
Mm-hmm. It's your turn, sir. I have nothing else on my list.
All right. Trick Williams is the one trick pony. The TNA angle with him as champion is doing nothing.
We're doing corporate fealty with TNA now. Yeah. I need to win this title to take it back to my company because somebody else from another company has it. It doesn't make the title that important.
And Trick Williams isn't like disrespecting the title in any meaningful way other than being the champion but a heel, which happens all the time in the company on a regular basis. So there really has to be a reason why this is such an affront. Trick Williams should put like an NXT plate, like a sloppy, stupid NXT plate over the front of the TNA title.
You can't do it because it's a mutually beneficial thing and it would look horrible. But this is one of those times where Trick needs to go on Impact or even on NXT and tell you why the NXT brand is better than TNA. Oh, I'm going to get a chance someday to go to the WWE main roster. How's that feel, Nick Nemeth? You know, that kind of thing. But you can't do that, really. And that's the problem with this angle. You can't have a brand war and not talk about brand superiority, which will then bury one of the companies, which then will become a talking point within itself. See AAA and WWE. I mean, it's such a bad angle to do. It really is at times where a guy from another company is your champion, Kenny Omega.
Yeah, and then we can talk Omega and Okada too. I think reprising Don Callis hating Kenny Omega is a completely dry well. There is no new story to tell here. There is nothing interesting that Kenny Omega and Don Callis can do. Don Callis, I guess, covers up Kenny Omega's promo gaps. But as we've seen in recent months here, Don Callis doesn't really need Kenny Omega to do his thing as one of the most popular heel managers in the company in terms of just attracting constant and steady heat. I don't like the act. The act is just boring. I think he comes out, he looks stupid, and then he says nothing. And it's not like, I get that a heel's not supposed to be likable, but this just has the change the channel sort of heat for me. And I'm not even angry about it. I'm just like, oh, this guy again. Jeez Louise.
Here's my problem, and it's a problem that you have in comic book world and movie world and TV world. I really like this lineup of the Don Callis family. I like Etchicero. I like Okada. I like Takeshita. I like the Protostar. I like Josh Alexander. I don't like Trent and Rocky all that much, but they're in there, and that's fine.
I think, like, he just needs like three more members, and then he'll be fine. Round it out to an even 10.
I'd put Britt Baker in there, to be honest with you. But
The Don Callis work program.
The problem is, and WWE did get around this when they had a murderer's row in the Heenan family. I need Don Callis to unleash the full force of this Death Star. And the problem with that is these guys would need to destroy the Elite, and they'd need to destroy the Death Riders and become the main badasses and the driving force within your company, driving storylines where we are the biggest, baddest faction in this company, and even go after the Hurt Syndicate, possibly. You know, because you got giant guys and they got giant guys. And be the driving force.
Is begging for a purgative wave like that. You're totally right. Like the heel side of this roster is begging for a culling. And I don't mean Sean Spears and Izzy Dame. I'm like the Don Callis family coming in and purging the Death Riders and the Elite into obscurity and putting the Hurt Business into almost a tweener role. I guess we should talk about them next.
Well, but hold on. Let me finish this point, because we've been doing half-assed versions of this story with Team AEW versus the Elite in Anarchy in the Arena, which means nothing. And we're building up probably to another one of these lame-ass blood and guts type stories where, because Anarchy in the Arena didn't get there, we now have to have a blood and guts story with Will and Swerve and whatnot. When you have this powerful force that could actually look and be powerful, because they're all giant men in this Don Callis family, come in and really put a hurting on this roster, where the roster has to look around and go, all right, we need to unite in some way to get rid of this thing. Otherwise, they're going to kill us all. Put all the belts on the Callis family and see what happens in terms of that. But we can't, because we get around these, the Young Bucks are bad vice presidents or whatever the hell they think they're talking about. And this, have Kyle and Takeshita murder death the Young Bucks. Really put them out for a while, because they tried to do that with the Death Riders and never got to that point, because no offense to, look, Claudio is unconvincing as a power guy, because his offense doesn't do anything. Moxley's a little bit too goofy as an angry heel trying to fix the company or whatever. And by the way, stop saying that your company sucks on the air, Will Ospreay. You're the reason the company sucks right now, John Moxley. Okay, great.
It's weird that, like, paradigmatically in the universe, they sort of, like, confirm that the quality of the work hasn't been there as of late.
Yeah, I mean, you have a powerful evil force that gets mad heel heat, and you won't go all the way with it because Kenny is kind of a B player now. You're still trying to get this Death Rider story over to keep Moxley happy. You don't know what the hell you're really doing with the Hurt Syndicate, so I'll throw it to you on that.
I don't think MJF's adding much of anything to the Hurt Syndicate as a storyline. There's nothing here that is superior to what they had when they were a three-man act. He just adds the wild card, zany MJF, Becky Lynch energy to the mix.
It's Owen Hart with better heat in the Nation of Domination. You remember that?
Yes. Except that, like, Owen is better.
Yeah, he's
a better promo, and especially some of the Nation stuff. He would have some of the funniest lines in those Nation promos.
I am
back
not
in
a
the,
nugget. Yeah.
I'm not even talking about that. I wish I could kind of like quote these off my head, but he was always good at the quick quip or the thing that would like just bend the promo front into that funny range.
Well,
and
what,
MJF, okay. I mean, beyond that, then the work with Owen was always there.
Yeah,
and
the problem here, I think, and let me posit this to you, is that by adding MJF, they have split the Hurt Syndicate to the point where it's kind of confusing people, because people wanted to cheer Shelton and Bobby as big jacked up dudes who did bad things to people. They liked that. They enjoyed that.
Right.
MJF comes in and he and MVP are on the mic trying to get the crowd to hate them while they still want to cheer Shelton and Bobby.
Right.
And it's causing all sorts of chaos in these segments. Because that's what the segments are right now. The Hurt Syndicate segments are chaos. Where
they weren't cohesive prior to MJF's arrival. And I get like, he's supposed to be fractious. But the story is just a mess now because of MJF. A key part of the story appears to be Bobby Lashley still does not like MJF. Which I think only further confuses the audience how to feel about the Hurt Syndicate when they walk out the curtain.
And that they're going to have heat with each other over the world title, in which neither of them are in the world title picture. Really.
Right.
For now, because we're going to have Swerve, Ospreay, Hangman, Moxley, whatever, and whatever fallout from that comes from it. So... yeah, it's a mess. I have nothing else. Do you have anything else?
I didn't think Moxley's promo to Paige about shaping up and I don't really get you and all this stuff. Once again, Jon Moxley in this title reign, just the biggest wet fart.
Is this better or worse than the Hangman title run, which I thought was a wet fart?
This is worse. This is worse. Okay. I feel like this is going on for an eternity. And it does not... unlike the Hangman title run, where he was a babyface, you know, solo guy kind of thing, and he just had like a bunch of kind of stupid story around him. Jon Moxley has an entire faction that he's doing nothing with. Like
he
it's
has an
not
ethos. He has an ethos, and he doesn't work towards the ethos.
No,
I'm trying to change AEW. How? I have the briefcase in it, or I have the title in a briefcase. Okay, yeah,
this is way worse than the Paige run in the sense that so much more nothing has been built around this crappy title run. Like the matches stink. And the guy has a faction. The matches stink. And the guy has a stated ethos that he's going to purge the company or something with his super dominant faction.
And then he does nothing with it. He never purchased the company.
The matches stink, and he has a valet who doesn't say anything and doesn't do anything. And if she disappeared tomorrow, no one would even notice it on the message boards for 2 weeks until someone pointed out. And they're like, oh, yeah, I guess Maria Shafir isn't here.
Don't worry, Chris. We're getting Chris Statlander possibly involved in this after that 1980s rom-com vignette with her and Wheeler Yuta. Hey, Chris, you need anyone you have to talk to? Oh, that dynamic charisma of Wheeler Yuta.
I know, right? Like the matches stink, and we have, you know, beaten dog Wheeler Yuta, who I'm supposed to care about. The matches stink. And it has made both Pac, who at sometimes is one of the more interesting wrestlers in the last 10 to 15 years, and other times is a complete dud. He is hot or not in a crazy way. And Claudio Castagnoli just absolute wet farts a human being. So like, no, this is way worse than Adam Page because there's so many more casualties of boredom due to Jon Moxley's wet fart of a title reign.
Let's go to Vader Club. Very interesting choice by you. Late, so I didn't have time to tweet it all out, but it's Furnace and LaFon. I'll still call him Dan Crawford. I don't care. Furnace and LaFon versus the Hardy Boys from Shotgun Saturday Night. Your commentary team of Ray Rougeau and Tom Pritchard, who are better tag team wrestlers than anybody involved in this match for the most part. But more on that later, I think. Pritchard is coming in here, and I usually let you set this up, but I have to say this. Crawford and Furnace / Furnace and LaFon were one of those teams coming from the internet age between 93 and 96 from All Japan who were called the best tag team in the world, and they get signed to ECW, and they're doing decent stuff, but not fantastic. They go from ECW to the WWF. And Vince looks at them, both 5'11", which blew me away. I thought Doug Furnace was so much bigger.
I know.
His stuff.
That surprised me.
And goes, okay, they're a great tag team, but they have no hook to them, so they're boring. He gives them the Lance Storm treatment, and Tom Pritchard is his avatar to talk about how boring. Because they're just good wrestlers with no personality, LaFon and Furnace are. But I'll leave this to you to talk about the match.
Yeah, so, I mean, I picked this because obviously there are better Furnace and LaFon matches. I think the Can-Am Express are just, they were beloved by the internet in the 90s, but I feel like the internet in the 2020s has forgotten just how much fun and how kind of unique their power offense was. They really are the best of mid-sized power offense-based stuff, where a smaller guy who's a power guy can kind of do those power moves, one, with crisper delivery, and two, with more rate. And that really kind of can come together in a very nice way. And also, Furnace and LaFon were nice complementary styles in ways that, like, they wrestle similar enough that they make sense as a tag team, but they also have individual styles in a way that sticks out, like in the way that the Midnight Express or a Rock and Roll Express does as well. I thought this was real interesting. I picked this out once I saw that they were having a match against the Hardys, and it went on for like more than 3 minutes. And I was like, well, let's see what this one's about. And what this one is about, to give you all the summary here, is the Hardys have now been kicking around the company for a little while, and they have impressed a handful of guys with their ability to bump, in particular Jeff's ability to bump and his fearless nature in taking bumps. That being said, a lot of the problems that we dog the Hardys throughout their careers, particularly Jeff, in terms of a lack of precision when it comes to doing offense, would be present here in this match 30 years prior. Jeff Hardy has at least one unbelievably nasty-looking bump during this match.
Is it the Miss Moonsault one at the beginning?
Yes. Yeah. He beans himself. I think that dude's out.
Or Tope. Yeah. No. Yeah.
No. He's going for like a. He's going for like a moonsault. Dragon salt. Yeah. Yeah. And he ends up just completely slipping out. Those boots do not give him any traction at all.
And he catches Furnace on the way down too, because Furnace is knocked a little loopy as well on that.
Yeah. But man, there's. It is basically straight down. Like they're like, oh yeah, he kind of broke his fall. Not really, because that's not how that move was supposed to go. And then they have to roll him in and do a cover and basically kind of like do a little bit of stall action here. But match progresses with Furnace and LaFon doing each one of them. LaFon first, and then Furnace next, busting out their power moves. Dude, I just love these guys' offense. They always have something that I'm not expecting, whether it's a top rope reverse suplex or like A Boston crab with a really good angle on it. Like everything they do, the little stuff is the big stuff. And that's definitely present throughout here. Hardy's for their part. Matt gets the hot tag. He comes in. He does do a springboard moonsault, mm-hmm. which was notable. Then Jeff misses yet another spot. And they have to, and they have to cover up again. And then ultimately the match kind of concludes with this nice little three-move sequence of like, what's it, like a drop kick, a clothesline, and then a DDT? Something like that.
Yeah.
It's like a clothesline into a DDT, but something else sets it up.
I can't remember right now.
Yeah.
I watched the match, but I'll try a little bit. Yeah, Doug Furness had such, like, he got the Jim Ross legit athlete treatment on both WCW and Smoky Mountain. When I was younger, he had a run in WCW in 1990, coming out of Continental, where it's like everybody's talking. You know, he played football at the University of Tennessee, and he's a power lifter. So in my mind, and this is how your mind can kind of, you know, atrophy a bit. I always thought of Crawford and Furness, Can-Am Express, Furness and LaFon, whatever you want to call them, as big power guy, smaller technical guy type of wrestling type of thing. Because that's what they were always kind of on the internet plugged in. And then you realize Doug Furness was a running back. He wasn't like a lineman or anything. He was like a 5'10", 5'11 running back who's just powerful. But like, I remember he did like a couple of matches on Smoky Mountain. And they also played like highlight reels of him. And they go, look at his athleticism for a power lifter. And I go, oh man, he must be 6'4 or something. And then he's not. He's a complete half foot smaller. And he and LaFon are basically the same size, but they have different body types and different kind of styles a bit. But Furness was always just, he was that guy that you thought, because they were trying to push him as like a Lex Luger type in 1990 in WCW. And he's not a Lex Luger type. He's not that tall like Lex Luger. He had that body, but you put him in there against, you know, other guys and you see his height and you go, we can't push him like that. Yeah. They're all Japan stuff. It's fantastic still. But yeah, Furness, like he was, and his brother, Mike, because Mike had a body too, but he wasn't as good and athletic as Doug. And in Smoky Mountain, they were bringing in Doug to get Mike over, and that just never really caught on. But as a bodybuilder guy, as a guy who really, you know, put himself in the gym, had amazing athleticism. It was just he wasn't that tall, and I think both guys being 5'10", 5'11", Vince looked at him and goes, eh, and you have no personality? I can't do anything with you. You're just a good tag team type of a thing. And you know, Vince always liked big guys, but, I can't push Doug Furness as a bodybuilder being that small kind of a thing. But
no, I know. And then Vince couldn't rack that big brain of his to come up with a gimmick for these guys when he came up with gimmicks, you know, all the time.
He's French. And they put him in like that, you know, they put him like in invasion angles and ECW when they went back as, you know, we're WWE guys. But it's like, and I think they were trying to put him with Cornette at one point in that NWA angle. I don't remember that correctly, I don't think. But that was the type of it's like, oh, they're good wrestlers. That's their gimmick, good wrestling. Oh, and Phil LaFon is French, so he's a frog.
Right.
Pritchard just, I like Tom Pritchard, but he was terrible on this show. He was just overbearing. I had to put it on mute at one point because I just couldn't take Tom Pritchard's commentary on this. And I respect the hell out of Tom Pritchard. He's one of my favorite people. But that'll do it for this show. You can follow me on X at CrapGame13. You can follow the show at ShakeThemRopes. I do a show on Fight Game Media called The Dynamite Show. Wednesday nights, 20 minutes after they go off the air. This week it was after 4 hours, so I was kind of tired and cranky. Myself and Paul Fontaine do a live deconstruction of that week's Dynamite. Drops in your podcatchers the next morning. You can follow Chris at Instagram at DOCTOR_NOV. He's going to throw in his plugs now.
Yes. I have a album coming out here later in the summer. Go ahead and subscribe on Spotify right now. The single should be dropping hopefully towards the end of this month here. I'll be waiting to get back the masters. I want to make sure everything sounds right, but they will be dropping soon. I have like two songs to do vocals on that I'm just going to be pecking away on as I'm getting back the masters over this summer. If you are interested in seeing the cool paintings that were done for me of my cats for my birthday, go and check that out on Instagram. I think they're cool. In particular, Shadow.
I like the Van Gogh one.
Yeah, the Shadow Starry Night one's real good. Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought that one came out great. So go and check those out on Instagram, DOCTOR_NOV.
Talk to you next week, kids.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is, how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.